yours was basically explaining cause number one towards World War III.
Yeah. oh, God.
It's going to be fine, guys. It's not. I've watched years and years. Welcome to the Worst Foot Forward podcast, where each week we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and this week you find me in the Worst Foot Forward vaults, jam-packed with Weimar Reichsmarks, Rhodesian dollars, and Ratner's jewellery. Myself and my co-host are currently doing our finest Scrooge McDuck impressions, lolling a carefree backstroke through the piles of disused cash. And here to compound your interest with some personal accounts, which will inevitably be to his credit, it's the always current Barry McStay.
Wow, that's a lot of puns.
Yeah. That is the most puns I've done in a confined sentence in my entire life.
I'm surprised we can fit any Reichsmarks and Rhodesian dollars in here with all the puns that are...
Well, as you know, puns are very valuable. Because a good pun is rare.
Yeah. The old Irish currency used to be called the punt.
It did.
Yeah, rather than the pound. Yeah.
But the punt, rather than
the Irish. It was the Irish for a pound. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It was...
We dealt in kicks.
Yeah.
I'll give you a punt.
Well, yeah, that's what 800 years of colonialism will do to you.
Yeah, you're very touchy people.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's the English who were touching you.
Yeah.
Just rather violently.
Scrooge McDuck.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone's dreamed of doing that little dive into the gold coins, haven't they?
Yeah.
Really dangerous.
Yeah, I don't know why they didn't have it just full of notes.
Yeah, that would have made so much more sense.
But it's tricky, because if they're in, like, big blocks like you get in gangster movies, then that's going to concuss you. It's got to be, like, a gentle sort of bedding.
Yeah.
Like a down of notes.
The other thing that always gets me in those gangster movies, when they hand over, like, a briefcase full of whatever, like, oh, $1 million in 50s. It's always like, they always look really impressed. Probably in real life, you know, the notes are actually, it's quite a slim volume of notes.
Yeah, I think $1 million probably doesn't look nearly as impressive as
the filled out movie briefcases they use.
Yeah. Also, like, DuckTales is Disney, right?
Woo! Sorry. If you're going to say DuckTales, woo! You've got to add on the
that is true.
At the end of it.
It's Disney, right?
Sure, yeah.
So, it's interesting that when the Disney writers wanted to come up with a caricature of a rich and skinflint-like billionaire,
yes,
they went for Scottish rather than what you would imagine Disney would go for. Like, Smooge McSchmuck is what they really want to do. Like, no, delete.
Yeah. How does your wife feel about, as a Scottish woman, about the Scrooge McDuck stereotype?
Well, yeah, she's half Scottish, half Italian. And Italians, I didn't realise.
Notoriously chaotic with money.
Like, politically, yes. And, but...
So your wife is the perfect balance, actually.
Right! She totally is. No, Italians are very generous in family terms.
Yeah, no,
it's always kind of like making sure... Like, Jewish mothers make sure you've eaten, and Italian mothers make sure that you've got money in your pocket.
That you can afford to buy your own bloody meals.
Right, exactly.
Listen, let's introduce our guest. Since starting performing comedy in 2014, our guest has been a finalist in major comedy competitions like So You Think You're Funny and Laughing Horse, as well as being named Piccadilly Comedy Club New Comedian of the Year 2016, the most important event to happen in 2016 by far. He has performed at the Edinburgh and Latitude Festivals, as well as major corporate gigs around the country, and supported both Dane Baptiste and Mickey Flanagan. His work has been shown and heard on the BBC, but he's not some straight out of college comedian, oh no. For before that, he was a writer for multiple publications, including The Guardian and The Times. He choreographed and performed Bollywood dances and directed a big play for a charity. Most pertinently for this podcast, though, he has a dark and dirty past, working in the rip-roaring, life-affirming areas of wealth management, local government, and corporate communications. So, whereas now as a comic he worries about dying, in his earlier place of employment, dying would certainly have been a blessed release. Here he is, alive and kicking though, Ishan Akbar.
Hello, what a lovely introduction, I enjoyed that.
I just rewrote your website's front page.
I like Dark and Dirty Past. I need to call my show that. Yeah.
Well, it's good you've lived a proper life before becoming a stand-up, rather than like, unlike most of us who have been like worked in market research and being a waiter
yeah.
and then eventually were able to go full time.
You know, well, some people go, oh, the comedy's a phase, you move out of it. Yeah. Now, for you, the real life employment was a phase.
Yeah, it really was. And I think that's just, I guess that's just the result of being raised in an Asian household where they have such ridiculously high expectations that becoming a banker was the least I could do. You know what I mean? Like when I was 6 years old, I remember being in primary school and all the kids were asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? And it went, you know, policeman, fireman, you know, taxi driver. I came out with ambassador. So you can imagine early doors, people like, who the hell is this prick?
What sort of version of an ambassador do you see yourself? Like a modern one where you're just, you know, hosting receptions and book launches and stuff? Or like in a Renaissance ambassador where you're part-time spy and potential assassin?
More Renaissance, I think, basically. So I was 6 years old and I had a few uncles who were ambassadors, and all I knew is that they had...
Your typical family.
Yeah, typical family. They sent limousines, back then when they were cool, they sent limousines with flags on them to pick us up.
Wow.
And we'd go to their houses.
And the ambassadors had to turf out the Hindus that were in there. Yeah. Like, clean the vomit off the seats.
Yeah, take off the stickers from the car.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I'd go to their house and like...
All be presented with piles of Ferrero Rocher.
Yeah, basically. And all these guys would be sat around my uncles, and they'd all have suits, and they'd be discussing like high politics.
Wow.
So I'd be like, oh God, that's what I used to have a lime...
Every six-year-old's dream.
Yeah, and I used to have this lime green tie, which whenever this uncle... it was a clip-on, and whenever he invited us, I'd take this lime green tie with me, and irrespective of what I was wearing, I'd put it on, sit down, and be like, let's talk about Korea.
Where were they ambassadors for?
One was the High Commissioner of Bangladesh to the United Kingdom.
Wow.
The other was ambassador to the United Nations, and another was ambassador to...
Was it a brand ambassador for L'Oreal?
Yeah.
Sort of decreasing level of importance.
Yeah, it was, you just had a lot of Avon ladies.
Yeah, basically. They told me they were ambassadors, I fell for it.
That must be really tough, because when you're like, in my experience of being 6 years old, is I had loads of sort of uncles or like fake uncles who you would have to try and outsmart them, and then they would like give you a wee present or show you a wee trick.
Yeah.
But it's fine because mine are all like, you know, low grade businessmen who it was easy to outsmart. But you're dealing with high end political players here.
Yeah, high-end political players who gave me sweets for effort, basically. If I tried to talk about Nicaragua or something, I'm like, okay, here you go.
Yeah,
said Nicaragua.
I've heard of a place.
Yeah. When I was a kid, my dad had been given some book, I think on the 1987 election in Ireland, and it was like a post-election summary of all the different constituencies and who'd won what seats and sort of clippings and stories from the election and all of that. And I, being a precocious child, somewhat similar to yourself, Eugene, I think I, with my younger brother, ran a fake version of the entire general election from 1987.
We
basically just voted. I think there's 42 constituencies in Ireland. I think I created 42 ballot papers. Myself and my brother voted on all of them.
Normal children create fake World Cups and then fill out the table for that.
I drew out the shape of the Dáil, which is the National Parliament, with 166 rectangles for all the and then filled in the names of the people as they won their seats.
You are.
And then I think they entered into coalition negotiations with myself.
Yeah, we would have been best friends.
I'd have loved it if Ishan would have then just turned up once the results were in and kind of like, I come from Bangladesh. Congratulations to the winner. So we found out clearly you're brilliant at being a precocious child and leading into being a precocious adult. What are you worst at in the world?
What am I worst at in the world? And I'm sure you've had this response before. There's just so many things to pick from.
That's a very diplomatic response, if I might say so.
I guess it would have to be I am the worst at being given a deadline that's months away and working to that deadline. So I'm very much a last-minute kind of guy.
So if we gave you a deadline for something tomorrow, no problem.
Yes, but if you said in 3 months, I'd be like, cool, I've got 3 months.
Yeah.
The night before, I'd be like, right, I've got to do this. So I'm the worst at keeping to a deadline, I guess.
Are you... Is that in every walk of life, or is that simply in professional deadlines?
Pretty much every walk in life. Every walk in life. I mean...
Like, what about ransoms? Like, if you were given... Like, going back to you being an ambassador...
I don't know... Yeah. Sorry, Ben, to cut across, but I don't know of any kidnappers who are a bit sort of lax with their deadlines and go, listen, 3 months is fine. Yeah. It slightly undermines the point of the ransom.
No, they like to play the long game. They know that it can take a while to get funds together from different sources.
The thing is, I guess as an ambassador, it probably would be wise to go as close to the deadline as possible to see and test their resolve.
Play the game of realpolitik.
Yeah, just really see how much they want this thing. So I'd go right to the
last minute. I pity your potentially kidnapped family members. I read about the word bankrupt to begin with. It's from the Italian banca rotta, or broken bench. Because if you lost your trader's deposit particularly in the Renaissance time, your bench that you traded off would be broken. So during the Middle Ages and into the Renaissance, medieval time, into Renaissance time, merchant banks grew up, particularly in Lombardy in Italy. So this is where a lot of the Jews fled to from Spain. They were fleeing pogroms. They weren't allowed to own any land in Italy.
We're rarely fleeing parties.
Yes.
We're just going to make an Irish exit here. It's kind of like, oh, the pitchforks are out. Okay, on we go.
Well, in Lombardy, there was a big trade in cereal, like wheat and barley and all sorts of stuff at the time. And so the Jews settled there and started trading from their benches in the Lombard grain markets, and because they could lend at interest. That was the big thing, because interest was usury in the Catholic Church. It was against the Catholic Church.
And it is in Islam as well.
Yes, yeah. Whereas the Jews were fine with it.
Yeah.
What can we say with God's business?
And like, because they were able to lend, they were able to then finance farmers to finance their crop growth, and they could provide insurance use it against the future price of the crop and give discounts and all sorts. So they were definitely the people to bank with if you were looking for a good deal.
I was just thinking, I'm surprised there's not a Jewish bank that operates, because obviously in Islam there's Sharia law banks. And these are mostly like the lack of, just no usury, is that what the main thing is? But I'm pretty certain that, you know, when you see the Frummers with the big beards and curly whirlies, they bank at NatWest like everyone else.
Maybe so.
I'm sure there must be some Orthodox banks though. Let's have a look, but there must be
to the internet.
Yeah, to the internet you go. But I'm sure I can imagine Orthodox Jews probably aren't too keen on.
Well, we like to two things. Firstly, we do like to make ourselves seem better than everyone else. Secondly, I put Orthodox Jewish banks into DuckDuckGo because I don't like to be spied in. And the second result, a list of banks owned by the Jewish Rothschild family.
Right?
Yeah. There you go.
There we are.
Well, conspiracy continues.
Yeah. The other thing that these Jewish banks were able to do was they were able to guarantee the delivery of the crop to the buyer. And so they were sort of playing both ends of the trade in that sense. And they would hold deposits for other people with bills against money, and they'd use these deposits to finance their own deals. So they were taking really high risks, because if a crop failed, or if they didn't make back the deal that they had used someone's deposit on, they could end up losing the entire bank, and they end up in bankruptcy. And this is where this whole idea of becoming bancarrota came from, that their bench would be smashed publicly.
I like that there's an element of professional wrestling in that well.
Yeah. You think they have like a cage where smash the chair over
there?
He's
got the chair!
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Apparently, there was a big deal in having, because when the Jews got this reputation for being great bankers, there was a huge amount of apparent so-called court Jews across Europe for about 400 years, between the 1400s and the 1800s, where princes and lords and kings would have their own personal Jewish banker to do these deals for them.
Oh, it's a bit like that the horrible thing that Trump said a couple of years ago about, it was along the lines of, I like my accountants or my bankers to be little guys with big noses wearing little hats counting money.
So
I was about to say something really on the nose, which is not ideal. it's a tricky one, because we are good at money because the other two major Abrahamic religions decided to create a rod for their own back.
And a rod for your back as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I read about Roberto Calvi. Do you know who he is?
No. Recognize the name.
He's God's banker, or was God's banker. He was the chair of Banco Ambrosiano in the 70s and 80s in Italy. And he, in 1978, it was discovered that several billion lira had been siphoned out of Italy through this bank that he was the chair of. And a few years later, he was sentenced to 4 years, suspended sentence as the chair of the company, and fined $20 million American dollars for facilitating these illegal transfers of money. Weirdly, he kept his position in the bank.
Well, I was going to say, you said it was Italy, but be more specific. It was the Vatican City.
This is the thing. So Banco Ambrosiano's major shareholder was the Vatican Bank. They owned 10% of it. And it turned out that between $700 million and $1.5 billion of debts emerged in the bank after this whole scandal in 1982. And a lot of this money had been siphoned through the Vatican Bank via Banco Ambrosiano.
Are you telling me, Barry, that the Vatican isn't necessarily the paragon of virtue they make themselves out to be?
Heaven forfend that I, as a lapsed Catholic homosexual, would ever suggest such a thing.
How dare you!
Yeah, I mean, what they really needed was some good Jewish bankers.
Sorry, yeah, that's what they really
needed. I was going to say, you said lapsed Catholic homosexual, I thought you were lapsed in both.
Lapsed Catholic!
Sorry. Used to like taking cock in a cross shape.
Yeah, that's what Catholic anuses look like.
Oh my god.
Wow, for the second week in a row, here comes the explicit rating. yes, so the Bank of the Holy See was a major player in the 70s and 80s, and in 1974 another bank that they were involved with, the Franklin National Bank, had collapsed, and they lost about $30 million because of that. The owner of that bank, a guy called Michele Sindona, he died in prison after drinking coffee laced with cyanide. You can see where all this is going. Again, as I say, the Vatican Bank emerged as a big player in the collapse of Banco Ambrosiano then in 1982 as well. 2 weeks before this whole thing about the major debts came out in 1982, Calvi had sent a letter to Pope John Paul II, basically saying the church will suffer the gravest damage if the bank collapses, saying we need to be bailed out. Obviously, it didn't happen, but it then became clear that it was commonly known in all the upper echelons of the bank and in the Vatican that illegal dealings were going. It seemed like the Mafia were putting money through the bank. All sorts of shady businesses from around the world were using it because, you know, people just gave it a free pass. And actually, in 1984, a couple of years after the collapse of Banco Ambrosiano, the Vatican Bank paid $224 million to the 120 top creditors involved in the case, just saying that they had moral involvement, but basically not admitting to any real fault in the thing. And they were given immunity in the whole investigation into the collapse of the bank as well. So,
I'd have loved, like, for the bailiffs to call round at St. Peter's Square.
And knock on the door of JP2's apartments.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of like, oh, nice place you got here. Shame someone was going to take that Leonardo da Vinci painting.
And park their car in a very awkward place in front of the door. So you And the camera crew follows them.
Yeah, yeah.
as you remember, I said Sindone, the owner of the bank Franklin National Bank, was found poisoned. Well, in 1982, a couple of weeks after the collapse of Banco Ambrosiano, Calvi was found hanging off of some scaffolding under Blackfriars Bridge in London. He'd fled Italy, and he was found there with bricks in his clothes, $15,000 in three different foreign currencies, and there was an inquest into his death. Obviously, initially they said it was a suicide. Convenient suicide. And then there was another inquest which found that it had been returned an open verdict. Eventually, in 2003, the London police reopened a murder inquiry into the whole thing. He was a member of a group called Propaganda Due, or P2, whose nickname was the Fratrinari, the Black Friars, so the Black Brothers. So the fact he was hanging under Blackfriars Bridge seemed to be, he was being sent a message. The guy who owned this was a guy called Lizio Gelli, who was a far right wing. Gelli was a former fascist, member of Mussolini's group, and his group had been banned, actually, under the Italian constitution in the 70s. So they were basically another underground group. They had possibly lost money in the banking collapse. The Mafia had lost money. The church had lost money. There were lots of people who had reason to kill this guy. And after they'd initially said, oh, he probably committed suicide, they then found that he had no paint stains on his shoes from the scaffolding. There had been paint spilled in the scaffolding, so he should have had that on there. Not only that, you couldn't have reached the scaffolding from the bridge, but you could have reached it if you were hoisted up onto it from a boat travelling underneath the scaffolding.
Oh.
So all of this very much seems to point to a murder.
I mean, I feel like that's a thing I should remember, someone who messed up the Vatican's banks being found dead in London. Because we all remember Litvinenko, Ukrainian...
Well, this was 1984, so you're not quite...
I was born that year.
Yeah, and your interest in politics and business hadn't quite...
Yes. Did he not come out out of your mother's wombs going, I bring you tidings.
In the 2000s, five people stood trial for the murder, but all of them were cleared. So it still remains an unsolved mystery as to what happened to God's banker. But he isn't my candidate for the world's worst banker. My candidate is John Blunt. Have you heard of the South Sea Bubble?
Oh, right.
Yeah. In 1720, the UK debt crisis had peaked. They needed £7 million to fund a war against France. They had £30 million in national debt. Their interest payments were £1.5 million. So they were in a really big hole. And a guy called John Blunt suggested they should just put him in charge. He had helped to deal with the debt about 20 years beforehand. He had sold tickets in the first real national lottery through his Hollow Sword Blade Company, HSBC.
No way!
Yeah, that he set up. They had stopped making swords in 1702, and they were essentially just a bank, despite the fact that banking was the purview, the sole purview of the Bank of England.
What's a hollow sword blade? Because it doesn't. It's
a type of sword.
It's a type of sword. What's the advantage of it being hollow? Does it make a nice ting ting noise when you do the old Errol Flynn?
Yeah, probably two sticks.
That's world class pub quiz trivia.
It's great. Yeah.
Really called hollow sword.
Hollow Sword Blade Company.
I'm going to refer to them as that and only that from now on.
Going to the local Hollow Sword Blade Company.
Yeah.
So this had been in 1702, when, as I say, this lottery had been set up. The HSBC convinced the government not to gift its recently conquered lands in Ireland to the army, but to sell it in order to try and pay off the national debt. And the HSBC bought £200,000 worth of the debt by issuing shares for £100. So every share is £100, buys £100 of the national debt. And then they were then able to use that to, you know, put people on the land, rent off the land, get money back from that. And they also got interest on the rent for the land, and they sold off these shares. So the bank made a lot of money from this lottery they set up. And people thought, oh, that's quite clever. Not only that, they also bought lots of the army debt privately, knowing the prices of that was going to go up because of the demand they would create. Basically an instance of insider trading. So they've been really successful with this first time round. So 1720, Blunt said, well, let's just do something similar. Let's set up some sort of, you know, company or lottery that people can buy into, and we'll help clear the national debt that way. So he convinced the Earl of Sunderland, the Earl of Stanhope, the Chancellor John Aislabie, to let him take over the national debts. And he said, for every £100 of debt, I'll issue £100 of stock in the South Sea Company, a company he'd set up to have a monopoly on trade in South America. South America, of course, being solely controlled by Spain at the time.
Whoops.
So he was selling shares at a company that he assumed they'd end up taking over South America, being the British, and they'd end up making money back for the people who bought into it.
So that's sort of like trading in futures, but the future is we're going to win a war against the most powerful empire on earth.
Damn right. And he said that if they could artificially raise the share prices somehow, then they could issue fewer shares to get the same amount of money and then sell the rest of the shares at the inflated price. They were looking for any angle on it they could. The price of the share, it was such a big hit across the country. Share prices rose 10 times. The shares were worth £1,000 by the summer.
Great.
It's insane.
It's going brilliant.
Oh, speculation was huge. There were maids and porters buying carriages for themselves. Like, everyone was, the government ministers were involved. There were the king bought into it. He made something like £86,000. He gave Blunt a knighthood. And other companies of the similar ilk grew up. People were setting up companies to buy the Irish peat bogs. They were going to manufacture spare cannonballs. There was a company set up with an advert in the paper asking for a £2,000 investment for carrying on an undertaking of great advantage, but no one to know what it is. And Blunt paid ministers off to set the ball rolling for this as well. The bubble, naturally enough, burst. People suddenly realized, hang on, we're not going to get any money back from this. There was a rush of people to cash out. Stocks crashed back to below the starting price. There were suicides all over the country of people who'd lost money in this, including the Postmaster General. There were 462 MPs and 112 peers were involved. It was a huge national scandal. And obviously lots of poorer people who didn't have other lands and businesses to fall back on lost out massively. As I said, maids driving around in carriages. The Riot Act was read at and there was sort of unrest at Parliament as a load of bankers showed up. Aislabie, the Chancellor, was expelled. and the South Sea Company directors were stripped of their estates, but not of their titles. And most distressing of all, maybe, Blunt got away with it. His son had bought him a lovely fine house with the takings they'd made from the South Sea Company, and so Blunt lived out the rest of his days in this house, having caused a huge national embarrassment and scandal and great misfortune for lots of people, rich and poor.
Well, I'm glad that we've moved on as a nation, that entitled upper-class twits who ruin everything that's great and good about us can not get away without their comeuppance.
It's the same cycle over and over again. As soon as there's a banking collapse, it's the poor people who end up paying for it, and there's very little comeuppance for those at the pointy end of business.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, in 2007, the poor weren't buying carriages.
No.
Their grannies were buying enormous carriage clocks.
Yeah.
And just living inside.
So I'm going to nominate John Blunt as the world's worst banker.
Okay. Very good. Strong stuff.
A Blunt, by the way, strong. An unfortunate name for a guy who makes swords.
Yeah.
Mine is a much more contemporary reference, and it is going to be to the most recent financial crisis that we had in 2007-2008, at a time when I was in the banking industry.
Where were you at that time? What bank?
2007-2008, I was at Barclays.
Uh-huh.
And I was doing wealth management for celebrities.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah, so
how many NDAs are you bound by?
Not anymore, I'm not.
Oh, cool.
Sweet, spill the beans.
But my clients were mainly in the sport, media, and entertainment space, so predominantly footballers, actors, and actresses. And
so the interesting ones.
The interesting ones, yeah. My biggest kind of portfolio were mainly footballers. I taught Anton Ferdinand how to make spaghetti.
Why?
At the time, he'd just completed his move to Sunderland, and he was in his new flat up north, and he was like, I need to make some food, I need to make some spaghetti. Do you know how to make it? I said, why don't you? He said, no. I said, okay, well, this is what you need
you
to
need
do.
You need to cook spaghetti or make it from scratch?
It was the bolognese.
Okay.
All right, I've just got that lovely image of you and Anton Ferdinand with the spaghetti maker, like wheeling it round and round, and you at one end of the kitchen and him at the other.
Come on, Anton, move quicker.
I can't, it's what I'm known for.
Yeah. I've got turning circle of a lorry.
I did not expect Sunderland to be a common denominator in both the three. The Earl of Sunderland.
Earl of Sunderland, Anton Ferdinand. Hang on. Is this within your actual job description that, you know, have to manage the wealth funds, give tax advice, make spaghetti for them?
Well, no, this is it. But it's all, you know, I guess it falls under the auspices of kind of like relationship management.
Okay, fine.
Build a strong relationship with the client.
Yeah.
They'd be more willing to give their money to you.
Yeah. I mean, there's like a lot of footballers, particularly back then, they needed kind of like a strong father figure to just help them through.
Yeah, and who better than a 22-year-old? to guide them through.
Who do you support in football?
Man United.
Did you ever take care of an account of a Man City or a Liverpool player?
No.
Oh, was it with the temptation of being to absolutely tank that shit into the ground?
Yeah. I did say, don't trust me with Eddie Dzeko's money. It's not going to be worth it.
Northern Rock, that's going to be good.
Yeah.
Edin Dzeko, heard of Iceland? Do you want to put some investments in Iceland?
the supermarket of the country.
The country.
Oh, yeah. Okay, cool. The country, cool. Yeah.
So, on Iceland then, that was one of a set suite of bankers that I was going to nominate.
Uh-huh.
Because they drove Iceland to the ground for the same reasons that everyone else drove their banks to the ground in 2007-2008. The one thing I will say is the person I've nominated is whilst he is a horrible person and a horrible banker, he's very much reflective of where society and the economy and the banking industry was at the time, which was this insatiable appetite for growth, for economic growth. And I've always been a strong critic of economic growth as a sign of progress, because it just puts pressure on creating these artificial forms of success. And then that's what proved to happen in 2008.
Why did the crash happen? Like in two sentences for people who don't really know.
The crash happened because in the 70s and 80s, people started creating these complex products that were based basically on mortgage lending.
Uh-huh.
And those mortgages were being given to people who couldn't afford to repay them. Yeah. But there was a 30-year period for these mortgages to be paid off. In the meantime, globally, other banks, because of financial liberalisation in the 1980s, were able to make investments in these products that were based on these mortgages. And no one foresaw that actually people are going to stop paying their mortgages because they can't afford to.
Yeah.
There'll be a lack of cash, and the cash that these these banks have borrowed from other places to be able to make their big investments elsewhere. Yeah. They ran out of cash and everybody was
they
like,
were all oh, investing okay. imaginary money.
Yeah, which is investing imaginary money. So yeah. the person I'm going to talk to you about was the kingpin of that, and that was, of course, the late, great Sir Fred Goodwin.
Fred the Shred.
Fred the Shred, indeed. And he was known as Fred the Shred because he was very good at cutting costs uh-huh. and the reason and cutting employees from
the reason that was one of the swords.
So Fred Goodwin, he's no longer a sir, but Fred Goodwin.
Oh yes, he was
stripped of his knighthood.
Yeah, it was shredded from his name.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which and that's a rare list.
He was degraded. Is that what they call it? Yeah.
Is it?
I think so. Yeah, I think they call it degradation.
Yes, you're right.
Degradation. Yeah, yeah. That's not the definition I've read on some websites.
Yeah.
Imagine that was the service I was applying for. Please take my title away from me.
Yeah. Please, I've been a naughty banker.
Yeah, it turns me off.
That was an unexpected kidney punch of a punchline.
We're really in the black now.
This podcast's taken a whole different turn here. So Fred Goodwin became CEO of RBS in 2000. And his whole project was to make RBS the greatest, most powerful bank in the world.
The Royal Bank of Scotland.
Yes, yeah. The Royal Bank of Scotland. And it all started with him buying up loads of other smaller banks, kind of in M&A, mergers and acquisitions deals,
yeah.
and calling this growth. So he bought NatWest for $26.4 billion in 2000. And he used RBS's cash and stock as currency for more deals. So when he bought NatWest, the markets were like, oh, this is interesting, you bought NatWest. You know, quite a powerful thing. So that drove the stock price up. And then what he'd say to people is, oh, look, our stock price is up. Give us more cash so we can do more of these deals. So they're like, okay, cool. So then one of the biggest deals they did was a $10.3 billion purchase of Charter One Financial, which was a Cleveland-based bank in the Rust Belt in America. And the Rust Belt in America at the time, they had a lot of mortgages there.
Yeah.
But they had people there who didn't really have much money. So immediately they should have rung alarm bells, but it didn't.
Yeah.
So Fred Goodwin's kind of approach to mergers and acquisitions and being relentless in it, he bought upwards of like 50 or 60 smaller financial corporations in a very short space of time.
And this is why when they talk about breaking up the banks, this is a demonstration of why it's so bad to have all the money concentrated.
Exactly. And that comes from something called the Sarbanes-Oxley Act. I can't remember which year it is, but the Sarbanes-Oxley Act tried to separate out the commercial business from the retail business of the bank. I can't believe I remember that. Fucking hell.
Wow. But and that's the thing that they still say we should do, but we still haven't done.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically, so we're saving ourselves up for a nice crash in the early 2020s.
Because the likes of, say, Elizabeth Warren in America are very big on that sort of
idea. Yes, but she's going to lose to Trump in 2020.
She's going to lose to Trump.
But also, you know, Fred Goodwin slightly benefited from the fact that globally, so for example, George W. Bush at the time was president of America. He favoured deregulation of banks.
Yeah.
And who was the head of the Fed at the time? Greenspan, I think.
Yeah.
He also favoured deregulation of the bank. So at the time, a lot of the regulation around banks was just being stripped and stripped and stripped away.
Do what you like.
Yeah,
this bubble's never going to burst.
We're obsessed with economic growth. And part of the reason people were so obsessed with economic growth is because wars are expensive.
Yeah.
You know, so if you're going to go to Iraq and you're going to go to Afghanistan, when the World Trade Center attacks happened, the American economy was really tanking. And this kind of deregulation happened very soon after, which enabled people to be able to make a lot of money very quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, wars are useful for kickstarting economies again.
Yeah.
There's most historians think that with FDR's New Deal after the Great Depression, the first couple of years, the New Deal worked.
Yeah.
And then after that, it tapers off. And the thing that kept the American economy going was World War II.
Yeah.
So for many American economists, they're like, whoa, thank God for Hitler. Not least because we can sell him weapons in the first 2 years before we actually join the war effort.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that's part of the reason why this kind of stuff happens, this kind of deregulation.
Yeah.
In terms of the M&A thing, the biggest one that I think that you need to be aware of is in November 2007, just a year really before the financial crisis really hit off, the Royal Bank of Scotland bought ABN AMRO in a $101 billion deal. And this was a month after Barclays, the bank that I work for, said no to the deal. And the reason they said no to the deal is because they weren't convinced that ABN AMRO had enough liquidity, i.e. enough cash in their reserves, to be able to deal with any potential shocks that could be in the system. And when Barclays first said that, that should have been an early warning to the rest of the markets to say, they're slightly concerned that there might be a liquidity crisis in banking in the next year or so.
Yeah.
But irrespective of that, ABN AMRO thought they'd get a cut price deal at $101 billion to buy ABN AMRO.
That's the amount of money that Real Madrid are going to buy their next centre forward for.
It's one Ronaldo.
one whole Ronaldo.
The weird thing is that, because I remember the time people saying the likes of, say, Vince Cable, and there was an Irish journalist called George Lee, and various people in America, and all sorts of various people sort of going, we need to, you know, calm down a little bit.
Yeah.
And everyone going, no, if you even mention calming down, it's going to cause a stock market crash. Let's just pretend there won't be a stock market crash, and then there never will be.
Yeah, and actually, that is that latter narrative that is the reason why this kind of thing happened, because in a sense, whenever a deal was made, it would have an uplift in the markets.
Yeah.
The markets would then see that and be like, oh, the market's uplifting, let's keep throwing money into this.
It's like that game you keep putting your hands on top of each other's hands.
Yeah, exactly.
Because actually, you're not adding anything.
You're not adding anything, it's just you're at the same level. And then the thing is, it just gets wider and wider, and more people that get involved, all of those people are going to fall off at some point. And
they're all hitched to the same wagon eventually.
Exactly, exactly that. The next thing that Fred did was he used Royal Bank of Scotland's capital reserves to make these purchases instead of their cash. So why that's a problem is when you've got capital reserves, so let's say, for example, you've either got a house worth £100,000 or you've got a load of cash of £100,000.
Right.
Once you put the cash into the economy, that can kind of swim in that economy and there's no one's really borrowing money against that cash.
Mm-hmm.
When you've got capital, you've got £100,000 worth of property, you can then securitize against that property because the property's there.
Yeah.
But the problem was that RBS were securitizing against capital assets that were being securitized against for all their other purchases.
Also, they're doubling up. They have two deals worth £100,000 and both of them are securitized against this one house, say.
Against that one house. But the value of that house, because it's in the center of the market, if that house collapses, everything else falls with it.
Yeah.
So actually the capital, the value of that capital got weaker and weaker and weaker.
Yeah, so they're balancing all of these stones on one single stone.
Yes.
And that stone comes away and everything collapses. Wowee. And
what they do...
I feel like I'm learning so much.
Yeah, exactly. There's going to be a short quiz at the end of this.
And what they do is they wouldn't really tell people that it was the same asset. It was the same kind of asset that they would...
Yeah.
So, and it's that wasn't legal, because it seems at best it seems stupid.
It was legal. Ugh. It wasn't not legal. None of this is not legal. It's just reckless.
That seems a problem that's not legal.
And it says here, Bloomberg wrote saying that under Goodwin's tutelage, RBS became Europe's biggest backer of leveraged buyouts. And what a leveraged buyout is you buy stuff based on debt products.
Mm.
So a product that is best based on other loans.
Yeah.
But if those loans collapse, and the value of that product that you're buying against also collapses.
Like the South Sea bubble. It's the same thing.
It's the same, exactly the same thing. So there'll be lots of... It is the same mistake happening cyclically. Happening cyclically. At one point... They boosted their derivatives assets by 44% to £483 billion in just the first half of 2008. So they boosted the amount of assets that they purchased by £483 billion in one half of a year. So at that
point, no one has that much money.
Of course no one has that much money. No one has that kind of money. And the reserves that they had just weren't enough to cover any loss.
Yeah.
So they did not have £483 billion worth of reserves to cover against. Because what Goodwin would say is, we'll just borrow money against that savings account, basically. And it wasn't a savings account. It was just this false idea that RBS was worth this much.
So much of modern banking, and maybe going back hundreds of years, it's a confidence trick.
Yeah.
Well, the whole market is predicated on speculation. Even, you've said in your story, the whole thing was about speculating that they'd win the war in South America against the Spanish. It's entirely based on speculation. Even when I was I was actually at HSBC in my last job, and I was a speechwriter to the CEO. And at the time, HSBC were in the final year of what was known as deferred prosecution agreement. So after the
that sounds like polite banker speak for we were complete shit, but we're going to get away with it.
Basically. So what happened is after the financial crisis, the Ministry of Justice in America put a 5-year deferred prosecution agreement on HSBC, saying unless you get your house in order, we're going to prosecute someone.
Oh fuck off!
Right, you've got 5 years to sort this out.
That's a very Al Capone approach. Like someone's going to get it. You can decide.
So, whom, right? They had 5 years, and HSBC were tasked with getting their house in order in terms of regulation. The truth is, they didn't, and they probably haven't, and they probably won't either. And so,
but after 5 years, people have forgotten that you've had a change of government
or
something.
Yeah, exactly, and you've had a change of leadership and everything else, and shareholders would come in and they'd pay lip service to say, oh, by the way, have you done anything about the regulation in the thing? And the CEO's job would be to say bullish statements, say things that would make shareholders and the markets feel placated, and at that point, the markets would just hold the value of the shares in HSBC. It was based entirely on speculation. You can have... You know, a company can have a bad run of business, but if the CEO comes out and is quite bullish in their forecast for what the business is going to be, the share price will hold up.
That's madness.
Oh, man.
Words have power.
But yes.
Even in financial markets. What else did he do? In 2006, 2 years before, he spent £500 million on building one of the world's largest trading floors in Stamford.
£500 million?
500, Stamford, Connecticut.
Why?
Because he wanted to show that RBS was, you know, one of the strongest, most powerful banks in the world.
Hang on, but that's half a new Wembley Stadium. How well kitted out is this trading floor?
This trading floor would have been, you know, the best of the very best. It would have had all every single bit of kit you could possibly imagine.
Working on Windows XP.
And beside every monitor would have been a little tray for you to be able to do your cocaine straight off.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
It would have been...
I think that's the change we need to do. We need to persuade people who work in the city to take marijuana rather than cocaine.
Just to chill them out.
Yeah. Then it's not about growth anymore. It's about cultivation.
You'd think... I think the biggest thing that Sir Fred did that makes him, for me, the world's worst banker is that he duped shareholders in such a great way. So all this stuff he was doing, he was buying things relentlessly. At some point, shareholders were like, Fred, have you got the money? Do you not need more money? And he's like, no, I don't need any capital from you guys. Absolutely, everything is fine. And then what he'd do is, once the meeting was done, he'd go off and start raising capital, right?
Whoa. Which
what he said he wouldn't do.
Yeah.
So in 2008, he said, there's no plans for any inorganic capital raisings or anything of the sort. A very front-footed statement.
Yeah.
But then in June 2008, this was in February, in June 2008, he sold about $20 billion in shares at 200p a share, which was a significant discount to the then market price.
Ooh.
At 200p a share at the time, the market price of an RBS share was probably about 420, 430, so almost at half price.
So he was just desperate to have some cash.
Desperate to get some cash raised.
Wow.
This was in June 2008, so we're just a couple of months away.
Out, yeah.
Before everything crashes. And then the final thing he did... And
presumably that caused alarm bells as well.
Absolutely. As soon as he did that, when he was like selling... raising capital, the shareholders were like, well, why have you sold our shares at a half price and why are you raising this capital? He basically said he's got another acquisition up his sleeve and it's going to be worth it. Mm. And the half price sale, the fact that he sold the shares at half price, not going to be a problem because once he buys this new company, it's going to be worth quadruple.
It's just lie upon lie upon lie. Yeah. It's so annoying.
And it's just confidence. It's just that confidence trick of saying, look, I've got the stats to back this up.
Ben, you and I would do, and Ishan, I'm sure, you do gigs, or you perform, or you meet people, members of the public, who, and they say they're a banker, you ask them what they do, they say they're a banker, and you start ripping the piss out of them. Some of them get a bit touchy about it.
Yeah.
This completely underlines why they have no right to be touchy about it.
Yeah, exactly. But equally, you know, we've all done gigs where you've accepted it, and then you got on stage and thought, oh, I don't have the gear to do what's in front of me here, but I'm just going to pile lie upon lie upon lie. To try and get out of this, and you're borrowing material from everyone.
Suddenly Ben's doing I don't look like a GP jokes.
Yeah.
They're like, we never thought you did. What? And so the pièce de résistance, I think, the final thing that makes Fred Goodwin the world's worst banker is his flagrant disregard for the public. And what I mean by this is when everything came to shit, there was a feigned meeting. Alistair Darling talked about this in his autobiography. There was a feigned meeting held at the Bank of England.
Alistair Darling, the former Chancellor of the Exchequer.
Former Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time. Held at the Bank of England with the then Governor of the Bank of England and the CEOs of all of the banks. And Gordon Brown was also there. And they were kind of discussing how will we stop this financial crisis from getting worse. And RBS basically came in. Fred basically came in and he said, well, the government has a responsibility to bail us out.
Yeah.
And at that point, the government were like, well, hold on a minute, we've got nothing to do with you, really. You're the bank that operates in the system we've got to do, and the Bank of England operates independently.
Yeah.
And so Fred's view was that consumers, because they were so credit hungry and they wanted to buy houses and they wanted to buy cars and they wanted to buy things they couldn't afford, consumers have a responsibility for what the bank did and why they behaved the way they did.
That's like saying that the people who take drugs are at fault, not the people who sell the drugs or whatever.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah, or, you know, if I just get in a car and drive it straight into a wall, then the AA have got a right to look after me.
Yeah.
So what he then did is he staged another rights offering, giving already brutalised shareholders an opportunity to add to their discounted holdings, this time at 65.5p a share. So we've gone from 400p to 65p per share.
Wow.
And the shareholders said no to this, so at which point the Bank of England had to come in and put in £20 billion to assume a 60% stake of the business. Over 2 years immediately after, the RBS share price lost value by 91%.
Ooh!
91% in 2 years.
Which, by Shred's, Fred the Shred's calculations, was about 2p.
2p, yeah.
About 2p. It's fine.
But what Fred had done, very cleverly, is just before he issued these this rights issue, he bought out his holding, make sure he had the cash that he needed to buy whatever he needed to and securitize himself.
Bit of insider trading.
Bit of insider trading there, just before he left. Happy to rescind his title. And RBS still remains government-owned. And at last checking, we, the taxpayer, have lost something to the tune of £37.6 billion in bailing out.
Wow. How much is that per person?
Hmm?
How much is that per person?
Oh, I don't know.
What it is, it's almost the amount of money that apparently we have to pay the EU if we want to leave. So if Fred hadn't done that, then we could Brexit so easily. So thank you, Fred.
Oh, wow.
Well, what I mean, that is, I love with you. I thought that was getting pretty bad about 5 minutes ago. Then you just kept piling.
Yeah.
And the thing, and the reason for me, he's the world's worst banker is because he was able to do the things that he did at a time where there was a lot of information available to all of us.
Yeah.
And also information available to shareholders who should have been wise to what he was doing. But Fred was reflective of this insatiable greed within the banking industry. And people, politicians included, central bankers included, would let him get away with it.
Yeah.
And so for me, he is the archetype of the very worst of what banking represents.
Yeah.
Yeah, massively agree. Thank goodness he's not Jewish.
Bloody straight white men.
Yeah, yeah. I first started looking at what's the smallest bank in the world.
Yes.
So if you go to Gammersfeld in Germany, there's a gentleman called Peter Breiter.
This already sounds like a Lord of the Rings setting.
Yeah.
Gammersfeld. Peter Breiter of Gammersfeld.
There are only 500 inhabitants in the tiny southern village, and he runs a cooperative bank there that is one of the 10 smallest in the entire country. There are no cash machines. And only recently did he get a computer, because he previously did everything like old-fashioned bookkeeping with typewriters.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
How long ago was this?
This is the present day.
Present day.
Wow,
in the 70s, he had about 7,000 accounts, and now he's just down to 1,100 because Deutsche Bank and Commerzbank have stolen some of his customers.
Wow. Those guys.
But imagine like a beautiful rural German village, like little chocolate box houses and lederhosen.
Lovely trees.
Exactly. Yeah. And so he opens up his door. I imagine he does a brief little song where bluebirds flutter down and land on his shoulders. And he walks 200 yards to his place of work.
With a pince-nez and a gold-tipped cane.
Yeah.
Nice. Does he have one of those really tall desks? Like, he just sits on a stool with, like, one of those...
Well, like, he's like, Christmas
like a lectern, like in a Christmas carol.
Yeah, and he's got kind of like one of those weird old accounting typewriters where you crank the handle and the receipts come out of it. He says...
Does he have a team of rats and frogs working for him? Is he played by Michael Caine in the movie?
No, he's a nice man.
Okay.
It's just such a lovely German approach to banking. He says, my hobby is my job. What could be finer?
Oh, does he have a big safe? Where does he keep the actual money?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. I don't know.
Under his mattress.
In his lederhosen.
Yeah.
I'd like to make a withdrawal, please. Okay. Unbutton the flaps at the back.
Just insert your card.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
So, that was quite nice. But anyway, enough nice of these. Let's go back to history.
That's it. That's the only bit of positivity we're getting.
Yeah, just a nice little local artisanal bank.
Okay.
Where, you know, just...
That's going to be the next wave of gentrification, isn't it?
Yeah.
Little artisanal banks.
Organic banking.
Organic banks. Yeah. That's going to be the next thing, I think.
Sweden was one of the places that had a first bad economic crash. In 1656, a chap called Johan Palmstruck was given permission by the Crown of Sweden to start a bank, the Stockholm Bank.
What did you say his name was?
Johan Palmstruck.
Palmstruck. It's the Swedish for a high five.
Yeah. and 5 years later, it became the first bank in Europe to give out banknotes.
Wow.
But lending rose rapidly in a few years, and the value of banknotes began to fall. And only 3 years later, the bank had to close for operations because they just couldn't give the banknotes, but couldn't give the customers their money. Palmstruck was imprisoned. The Crown took over the bank and found what is still today the Riksständers Bank, which is the National Bank of Sweden.
Oh.
So basically, what I love is that Sweden nationalised its banks like almost immediately. Like, this can't be trusted to private enterprise.
Yeah.
So once again, Sweden knows best. we haven't mentioned, I thought one of you guys was going to mention Nick Leeson, famously destroyed Barings Bank over here by being a rogue trader. He lost, I think, about $2 billion on his own, and that's quite impressive. But there were
The thing that gets me now is he does like motivational speeches and stuff after dinner talks.
Well, it's like the Wolf of Wall Street does that as well. There is, like, so Barry does a lot of immersive theatre, have I? So stuff like Secret Cinema.
Yeah, okay.
You can now do an immersive Wolf of Wall Street experience.
Wow.
Can you imagine how horrifying
every
that
Friday
is?
At Citigroup.
How bad the audience members
would
be.
Just gross. I'd love it if all the audience members was just people pretending to be part of Occupy.
No, you get to choose whether you're on the side of Jordan Belfort, is that his name?
Yes.
Either on his side or on the other side. I would like the people who decide to be against him, they actually get put in charge of a pack of actual wolves,
So someone probably worse than him is a gentleman called Jerome Kerviel, a 31-year-old who in January 2008, so I'm sure he was part of this whole crash, he lost a bank $3.7 billion.
Ow.
So he had been betting upwards of 50 billion euros of the bank's money on various trades. Again, it's basically betting money that he didn't have. There's my favourite rogue trader, though, is...
we've all got a favourite.
A Ghanaian national called... Yeah, do you know him? Kweku Adeboli.
Yeah.
He worked for UBS.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was sentenced to 7 years in jail for $4 billion.
What did he do? Just again betting on things that... This is the thing that really fucks me off, is that people are putting their money in, and then we go, here, just basically bet with our money and see if you're right.
The thing is, with these guys, I mean, the only bit of sympathy I have for them is when you work as a trader in a bank, you are given a capital limit. So the bosses decide how much you're allowed to play with.
Right.
And they give you this based on your performance so far.
Mm.
And they also task you with saying, make me as much money as you can.
Yeah.
Which incentivizes these guys to say, well, I'm going to do the most reckless possible trade because the uplift is going to be... And as soon as it all fucks up, they're the ones who become the fall guys, when really it's the big bosses who are the ones tasking them, and they don't go to jail.
It sort of reminds me of Formula One racing in the 50s and 60s, where the actual drivers were literally putting their lives on the line far more than they were even in the 90s or noughties. And, you know, they would be going, we're not going out on this track, we're going to die.
Yeah.
And the owners of the car companies would be like, I've plowed all this money into you, go and do it. And they'd be there, like, with the car on fire. And these guys are like that as well. Yeah, he lost the biggest amount of money that a single person has lost, which is $2.3 billion in unauthorised trades. I'm going to briefly move us out of the world of banking and move to a slightly different bank. In Canada, you know where this is going, don't you? Sperm banks.
There it is.
Yeah.
I'm surprised that we've not been there already.
I kind of knew you would. I thought, you know, it would be typical of me.
So it is really tricky to become a sperm donor in Canada. They've got really high standards. So
what standards did they set?
I'm about to tell you.
Oh, okay.
So in the United States, you can get paid as much as $150 for a cheeky squirt of healthy sperm.
Wow.
You get paid?
Yeah.
Is that the case over here?
I think it might be.
Yeah, it is.
Is it?
For some of them, it's only if it's private. Are you suddenly thinking, I am
all the money I've wasted? I know. I reckon I could have, even if it was just that 50 quid a pop, I could have made like 2.3 million pounds.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're not retiring.
You've broken bearings back. Don't worry, yeah. I'm going to jizz into this pot.
I'm going to jizz.
And we'll all retire to a sperm bank tax haven. Welcome to Semen Island.
Welcome. Only wankers welcome.
Yeah.
So, if you want to donate sperm in Canada, you have to undergo a rigorous review of your family's medical history, a personality survey, an in-depth genetics test, regular blood and fertility testing repeatedly over the first 6 months.
So eugenics, basically.
Yeah! I mean, yeah. Canada, sort of like Scandinavia, do have a bit of a eugenic-y past.
Yeah.
They try and brush over. I'd say comb over, but obviously if you breed people, probably they won't have comb over.
Yeah.
So that means because there's the market is working very well in America, you get loads of Canadians are going over the border going, I can make $150 a time here.
Yeah.
And it means that there is a huge shortage, or there was in 2013, a huge shortage of sperm donors in Canada. It was reported that more than 90% of sperm used in Canada was imported from America.
Oh no, what?
Wow. That's really upsetting.
Yeah.
Subverting system. I've just looked it up. In the UK, donation in exchange, sperm donation in exchange for payment is prohibited by law, but you do get £35 per clinic visit to cover expenses.
In the UK?
You can also claim for accommodation, travel and childcare.
I mean, as part of the expenses, can you claim your Wi-Fi router subscriptions to various websites?
I think you should claim for the expense, the lost sperm. So every time you donate some, you get some back.
In what form would you get the sperm back?
Injected, back in. A one in, one out sort of system.
What, so instead of a condom, you've just got a tiny little bouncer on the door?
Yeah.
Before we go to my choice, we're going to talk about a gentleman called General Gregor MacGregor.
What? The classic.
Yeah.
The captain of Boaty McBoatface.
Yeah. I mean, you might not be far out. He was a Scottish soldier, adventurer, and confidence trickster.
That's in our wheelhouse. That's completely the CV, a guy called General Gregor MacGregor.
Yeah. And he worked in the world of South America again. This is about 80 years after the South Sea bubble.
Okay.
But almost 100 years after the South Sea bubble. And he tried to draw British and French investors there by inventing a fictional Central American territory.
Yes!
That he claimed to rule as the Cazique, which was a sort of a word from the Mosquito language for king.
Yeah, I've heard of this dude.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. And basically, hundreds invested their savings in the place he called was Poye, was this country that he made up.
After the Uruguayan footballer, Gustavo.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Who is immortal.
Yes.
Like people try and stick a reducer on him, and he's just like, brushing it off, mate. Not a problem. And so he got them to invest loads of money in government bonds and land certificates, and even 250 people actually emigrated to the invented country.
What the fuck?
Only to find that there was just untouched jungle, and then half of them promptly died.
Yeah, didn't they say...
We could start Sperm Island.
We could totally start Semen Island, yes.
Semen Island.
And we don't even provide any transport. People have to try and swim there, and whoever gets there first, they're the people who get to stay.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's the appropriate way for Semen Island.
And you have to break an egg when you get in. Yeah. Initiation.
Only the fittest people may survive in Semen Island.
I love that you're basically doing that into the plot of Rat Race.
Yeah.
Like you get to the end and John Cleese is there going, "Welcome to Sperm Island." Obviously dressed as a giant sperm.
Yeah, exactly. So they sort of sailed to Brazil or something like that, didn't they? And then he sort of said, "Oh, it's inland," and they just made the way into the Amazon.
Yep, yeah. Exactly. And he claimed to have been commissioned by Simon Bolivar, who was behind loads of the different revolutions against the Spanish colonies. And what was brilliant about it is that he, when he came back to Britain, like so many people who were involved in colonial exploits around the world, he was sort of heralded as this great gentleman adventurer, had all sorts of brilliant stories, and he went round all the various dinner parties. He was considered, in the words of one journalist at the time, a great adornment for the dinner tables and ballrooms of sophisticated London.
Wow.
And there were rumours that he did his best to find that he was descended from indigenous royalty. He brought with him the princess of the Poirier, who was called Josepha, who gave birth to a girl named Josepha Anna Gregoria, and they lived at McGregor's sister's home in Ireland. He was even invited to the official reception of the Lord Mayor at the Guildhall. So he basically talked himself all the way up.
Amazing.
What, is that Roberto Martinez?
Yeah.
He falls upwards.
Yeah.
Well, McGregor had a very attacking style. Colonialism, but left himself open and
style,
exposed at the
style
back.
Style over substance, this guy. Did he get found out? I mean, aside from the people who died.
Well, he sort of got away with it, to be perfectly honest. So one of the things he did, in order to sort of start off the con, he realised in this area there were loads of sort of like little, I guess, kinglets of the area of the Mosquito people.
Yeah.
There were like small kings or chieftains of the Mosquito people. And chief among them was a chap called George Frederick Augustus. And he got him to sign a document granting McGregor and his heirs huge swathes of territory, upwards of 8 million acres.
Oh, so fucking hell.
Yeah, all in exchange all in exchange for rum and jewellery.
Wow.
But one of the reasons that sort of helped with the con is it was completely unfit for anything. There was no real resources there. You couldn't cultivate land there. You couldn't stick livestock on it. But it was like, there's my capital.
There's a swamp.
There's a swamp. Invest in it and I will nick your money. Weirdly, he was still liked in South America. He was put on trial for fraud in a French court in 1826, but was acquitted. And he kept attempting Poirier schemes that were slightly less ambitious but still grand.
Wow.
For the next sort of 10 years or so. He moved back to Venezuela, where he was clearly quite a charismatic guy and was welcomed back there as a hero. And he died in Caracas in 1845 and was buried with full military honours.
Oh, fuck that guy.
Yeah, well, look, come on, we've all enjoyed South American football and they love a wrong'un. It's not about how well you play, it's within the rules, it's how much you can bend the rules.
Yeah, this is true.
So he's a remarkable figure, but for my choice, we're going to talk about a chap called Alexander Fordyce. Who was part of another banking collapse, this time in 1772.
Uh-huh.
So Neil James Fordyce and Down was a London banking crisis. Their collapse precipitated the collapse of almost every private bank in Scotland and a liquidity crisis that broke both the London market and the Amsterdam market.
Brilliant.
And what they've been doing was shorting the East India Company on an enormous scale, using customer deposits to cover losses.
Oh.
Yeah, and Fordyce, yeah, like Ishan's nodding, just going, a classic.
Classic
ruse. So on, and Fordyce was a right slippery bugger. The day before he fled to France, he was reported to have come home in wild spirits, saying that he has told the wary ones and the wise ones with heads of chicken and claws of a corby that I would be a man or a mouse, and this night, this very night, the die is cast, and I am a man. Bring champagne, bring burgundy, let tonight live forever, for I, Alexander Fordyce, am a man. I mean, coked up to the eyeballs, clearly.
And you said the next day he fled to France?
Because his bank had to close.
What a man. Yeah. What a man.
2 days later, three of the London banking firms of Scottish Connections collapsed. 12 days after he fled, 22 more banks went down, notably Scottish Douglas, Herod & Company, that was previously known as the Air Bank. The Bank of England had to stabilise the situation. There were runs on Drummond's and Coutts, which is the millionaire's bank that we've all heard of. Then the liquidity crisis spread to Amsterdam. This is where things get really interesting, though. The crisis led to a worsening of relations between Britain and the 13 colonies in America. And amongst the stressors, the East India Company was weakened by what happened in the crisis, and managed to persuade Parliament to pass something called the Tea Act. Exempting it from duty on all other importers in the colonies.
Yes, I know about
and
this.
That then led to the Boston Tea Party, which kicked off the American War of Independence, which has ultimately led to us having President Donald Trump in the White House.
Oh, good.
Bit of a stretch.
Good
bit
link.
Of a stretch.
Almost 200 years later.
Almost 200 years later, I like to zoom out and look at the big picture.
Yeah, macro. It's important.
So because he managed to take out not just banks, he took out entire markets and led to a hugely costly revolutionary war that admittedly on the pro side did give us Hamilton. I'm going to suggest that Alexander Fordyce was the world's worst banker. Our suggestions for the world's worst banker are Barry's of John Blunt, who blew the South Sea bubble, Fred the Shred Goodwin, who blew all of our savings in 2008, and Alexander Fordyce, the cocksure Englishman who ruined Scottish banking and precipitated the American War of Independence.
So, sorry, three straight white men have been the nominees.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As far as we know.
I'll level with you, I don't know much about banking in the Mughal Empire. And clearly we know that Muslim bankers were very conservative and would take these big risks. And, yes.
I'll be honest, I didn't feel comfortable pointing at a Jewish bank.
I'll tell you what, in the Muslim banks, though, when a customer came in to withdraw her money, identifying her was a fucking nightmare. That really tickled the
such a childish
joke. You know when they have the signs in back saying, you know, couriers have to remove their helmets
So when I did any kind of cashiering in the bank, if there was a burqa clad woman, we would say that you would need to remove your veil for us to identify you.
Yes.
They would often say, I need to see a female.
Yes.
That's okay, fair. Well, obviously, if a Hasidic Jew goes in there, you go, you're going to have to remove your big strimal hat. And they take the hat off and the curly whirlies and the beard come with it. It's just a bald man underneath, featureless. So, let's decide who's going to be the winner. God, this is tricky. I really like how cocky Fordyce was. Like Fred the Shed was, my God.
Fred the Shed. Call him Fred the Outhouse, it'll be easier.
Yeah. He was on Gardener's Question Time. Fred the Shred was an awful, awful, terrible man, but he didn't have the charisma that Fordyce did.
Yeah, I mean, he charmed his way to... He did, because he knew how to play the game with other bankers.
Okay.
He was charming to other bankers. Other bankers loved him.
But I say, to anybody else he met,
Not the level of charm that I would want.
Yeah.
He doesn't seem like a people person.
No,
Fred.
he wasn't really a people person.
No, he really doesn't. And John, I'll level with you. You two went into a lot more economic and financial detail than I did, and I have forgotten how the South Sea bubble worked.
Yeah.
So it's really tricky. I think I'm going to get rid of Alexander Fordyce, because as me and Ishan have agreed, he did precipitate Hamilton being a thing, and it's the greatest musical of all time.
There we are.
After Avenue Q.
Oh,
Avenue Q was.
It's great, but it's no Matilda.
It's like saying, Ben's pretty good at sketching, but it's not the Mona Lisa.
I'm tempted to go with the South Sea bubble because it's so iconic, but Ishan A did his homework, and B.
Literally, like, for several years.
Yeah. And he genuinely managed to explain a very important piece of current affairs and modern history in a way that I was able to understand and possibly repeat to other people.
Yeah. Oh, I'm glad about that. Yeah. Thank you.
Also, it seems only fair that I do the most diplomatic thing to our ambassadorial friends.
Oh, thank you.
And suggest that Fred the Shred is the world's worst banker.
I don't think there'll be many people who disagree with that.
No, so we can look forward to fetching the tar and the feathers.
Yeah.
Before we go, I'm going to tell you about the world's worst news of the week. And we go to America, we go to Washington, D.C., we go to the White House, where you might remember a few months ago, French President Emmanuel Macron and Donald Trump planted a young oak tree.
Ah, yeah.
As a symbol of friendship between the two nations. This was a...
Friendship?
Yeah, very nice. Friendship. Puns. There's been a run on puns, man. Sell.
The tree came from the Belle Eau Wood in northern France, which was one of the places where thousands of Americans died near the end of World War I. And Macron said this will be a reminder at the White House of these ties that bind us. However, a few days later, the tree was taken away because all living organisms imported into the US have to go through quarantine.
Yep.
So Trump is now putting not only Mexican children, but French trees in concentration camps. And I'm sad to tell you that the tree died in quarantine.
Oh.
So the sign of the sign of Franco-American friendship, rather symbolically, has passed away just a few days after the joint D-Day commemorations in France.
The streets of heaven have far too many urban planted trees on them tonight.
Before we go, Ishan, where can people find you and what can they find you doing when they get there?
So I'm previewing my new show for the Edinburgh Fringe Festival called Infidel-ITY.
Oh, that's a stretch.
Tiny. I have to say the whole thing. Go on my website, ishanakbar.com, to find out where I'm working on the show, or you can find me on Twitter at Michael Packintyre.
It is the greatest Twitter name of all time. We'll just let that really percolate through Barry's mind. And you're also part of a podcast as well.
Yes, so Quotas Full, we're on every single week. Find us at Quotas Full. It's a great little podcast, me with four or five or six, however many comedians turn up. And we just, chew the fat on all sorts of things going on, current affairs. They talk a lot about hip-hop, which I'm not really privy to, but yeah. Smile and nod. I'm like, yeah, okay, yeah, cool. Yeah.
Smashing stuff. We're all off to Fred's shed to snort lines of compostable cocaine. Until next time.
Bye.